a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everybody, Aaron Noonan, great to have you with us. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. This is episode 224. All even numbers for this podcast. No odds here, but I'll be the odd one. The one to even me out, though, today is not Will Dale. It's a guy who you know from the Castrol Motorsport News podcast. He is dominating. He's award-winning. He is Stefan Bartholomaeus, and he's in our building. Stefano, welcome back to – oh, it's been a while since you've done one of these. Are you a little rusty?
Well, Aaron, it's great to do a podcast in person. Andrew Van Leeuwen and I are a long way away when we record our Castrol Motorsport News pods. So, yeah, fun to do this in the Sleuth headquarters.
This is a Q&A episode. We have questions. We have answers. Well, our fans, our listeners, our readers on socials and online have questions. We hopefully have answers and in some cases opinions that might also form answers. So let's bowl in. Paul Paddy first up, High Head Sleuth. Is that me or you?
I reckon that would be you.
Good, correct. Well done, you can stay. What happened to the 888 Falcon that ended up with the tyre through its windshield during the 2005 Bathurst? Was it the same car that won the race in 2006? Simple answer?
Yes.
Correct way. Why do you know this, Stefan?
Well, the 888 The Cars book that's being compiled by V8 Sleuth at the moment that will be out next year will obviously feature this car pretty prominently. Partly because it won Bathurst, but also it had quite a reasonably long life with 888 starting in 05 as Craig's season car.
Well, so therefore it's the first 888 winner. Remember that he won at Eastern Creek to get them on the board to begin with. It's the first 888 pole car from Pukekohe for Craig that year. Won the Sandown 500 with Yvonne Muller. Had the wheel through the window at Bathurst 05. Nearly won the championship in 05, second to Russell Ingall. 06, of course, the Bathurst win is so well known. Second in the championship again in controversial circumstances. And I'm pretty sure that car was wheeled out again the following year. So, because Wincup started the year in it, didn't he, from my memory. So it did a lot. It's a very special, not just because it won Bathurst, which is clearly what makes any car very special, but it did a whole pile of other stuff. So it'll form a pretty big part of this book when that comes out next year that you are heavily working on.
And the wheel through the windscreen wasn't the only major hit it copped either. It had that big one at Simmons Plains where Jamie was driving in 06 just after
Bathurst. That's
right,
yeah.
And then later in life, I think its only race outside of 888 was with Jesus Racing as a Bathurst wildcard where it had a big one at the top as well.
I think it had a couple of hits in 2009. So that was the last time it ran and it was restored later on. And it's now up in the Muscle Car Warehouse in Sydney, having been with 888 for many years. So, Paul, there you go. There's a bit of info on the 05-06 car. Indeed, they were the same and a pretty storied car from history as well.
It's certainly a car that shows that everything is for sale because the way that Roland Dane talks about winning that race in 06 and the importance of Bathurst to him, the fact that he was happy to sell that one, I think says a lot.
I think it also says that he got a very big number for it. He didn't sell it for a can of Coke and $2.50, that's for sure.
All right, so we've got one from Chris Holborn. Hi, team. I've recently been watching some old ATCC races from 1989 and noticed that there was a number 26 Sierra entered under the Brock Racing banner, driven by Tony Noski. What was the story of this entry and where did this car originate?
So I can fix up a little part of this. It was 1990, not 1989. So Tony Noski was involved in the whole Brock Mobile One Racing setup. Of course, remember that they were doing Falcon road car tuning and Mavericks and all sorts of stuff. This is after Brock's busted up with Holden, the BMW things happened, and he's in the Sierra program by this stage. So Alan Gow's there, Noski's there, Brock's there. It's all part of this whole tie-up. So this was the third Brock car in the 90 championship for three rounds. I had to look this up to remember. Simmons Plains, Phillip Island, Winton. And Chris is right. Tony Noski, car 26, Brock Racing or Brock Shop or whatever it was on the side of it, white Sierra. That was the car that Barry Sheehan had shunted the previous year. Remember, he went and had a run at Winton and put it in the fence, the 105 car. That was that car revived for the following year because Andrew Medecki had joined the Brock team for 1990 to drive the second car. So this was a third car that popped up for a few rounds, but it met a pretty bad demise because it became the Medeki number six car for Malalar, while his car was off getting rebuilt before the Enduros, and he ended up over on his lid after a little touch with his old Formula Pacific rival, John Bauer, and that car was crushed, like literally crushed. Afterwards, it was declared a write-off, and they I've seen the photos. They absolutely flattened it like a pancake. So, and Chris asked, where did that car originate? Well, of course, the Brock cars came from Andy Rouse in the UK. There were two cars from 1988 that came to the Brock team for 89, and then they Den car, Georgie Smith and Dennis Watson, they built a new chassis for Brock for that debuted at the Enduros 89. So there were three Sierras in the mix, and therefore that's why there were three. So, no, good insight. Chris, that's one that many people won't have sort of thought about over the journey, the forgotten Brock Sierra, I guess you would describe it as. Justin Alden, this is a good one. I'm really interested in this. Noons, I'd like you to ask Stefan the same question you asked Howie in your recent podcast. Should the media be reporting on the off-track scandals of drivers in the same way that footballers' lives are scrutinised, or is the potential fallout too risky for the sport? Now, I think my chat with Howie was more about not whether they should or shouldn't, but it was more a case of should we take the fact that it barely ever happens as a bad thing that for supercars, for motorsport, that media just aren't paying enough attention or care enough to either hunt it, find it, or publish it. That was kind of more my discussion point on it. But what's your view on this? I'm interested.
Yeah, I guess you could look at that either way, that that sort of thing being publicised is either a sign of success of the sport or it's a tax on success because it's not something in general that you're really going to want out there. So, yeah, I mean, the sort of stories that are genuinely in the public interest, that old journalism phrase, and things that interest the public are actually two very different things. Mm. And now you see, especially with the internet, like all these things being written and a lot of stories being generated out of social media posts, especially with the footballers is where they seem to get in a lot of trouble, is generated out of that sort of stuff. And the media outlets just know it'll click. But drivers in general are a bit more commercially savvy, I think, than your average footballer. So they don't sort of, there's not that loose content getting out in the first place.
But that's not to say that there's not loose things happening behind the scenes. It's just that the sport is not in as illuminated light position as AFL, NRL, cricket. They're probably the top three that you would say in the Australian market. Motorsport is a niche sport. It always has, it always will, despite our love for it and our protests that, I mean, I open the paper so often down at the cafe here while I'm waiting for a lunch or whatever, and it goes days on end with no motorsport in the Herald Sun here in Melbourne. Not even Formula One, and there's always something going on in Formula One. So that's the level that we're at. It's been that way for a long time, and I don't see the marker moving. Occasionally there's it's got to happen with, we saw Craig Lowndes in the paper last year for some stuff that happened away from the track, but it's got to take someone, it's a massive, massive name for it to even get to the broader media. There's plenty of other things. I've seen it, you've seen it, we've heard all sorts of stuff around the scenes over the years of things that if they were football, they're in the paper. So someone's reporting that somewhere, but in our world it's not. And I get your point too. In a way, that's a good thing because when you are a niche sport, the last thing you need is bad press. But is any press good press to help grow your sport and grow the awareness and grow the care factor? It depends if you're the person being splashed on the paper, of course, but I think it's one of those scenarios that I don't see it changing anytime soon.
Yeah, and this is where specialist media is very different from the mainstream as well. I think in all cases that, if there's a genuine issue where someone's been charged or something like that, it's the duty of all media not to walk past that sort of behaviour and sort of cover that up. But when it's just sensationalist celebrity voyeurism for the sake of stories, then that's certainly not a end of the pool that I'd want to be swimming in at any point.
Mm. Mitch Drysdale, his question is, when's the last time a team owner or team principal was a Bathurst co-driver? He said Wink Cup this year. As Todd and Rick Kelly were never co-drivers, it wasn't them, but perhaps it's Larry Perkins. Any ideas? Well, last year, this year, there's team principals driving.
Yeah, Tim Blanchard. This, believe it or not, was the only question we did any pre-brief on, just a 30-second chat in the cafe to make sure that I didn't misunderstand the question. But, yeah, Tim Blanchard's the current example of that, and Jonathan Webb was most recently in the race last year and won it in 2016 as a owner and co-driver. So, yeah, a couple of pretty recent examples right there.
Yeah, don't have to look very, very far at all. Matthew Davis, any chance of a book on HDT race cars? By the way, really enjoyed reading my copy of the new edition of the HRT cars book, which is good because that makes you and I feel very good because we put that together, which is available now, superstore.v8sleuth.com.au. I nearly tripped over saying that because of all those S's in there, but perfect idea for Father's Day. We've got heaps of good stuff in the store at the moment. We've got some more stuff coming, books, prints, DVDs, model cars. There's plenty of good stuff there. Join our mailing list too, our newsletter list, because we will have a Father's Day sale in the lead up to keep you abreast of what's coming or what's available, and we'll do some good deals. So get on our newsletter list. A book on HDT race cars sounds really interesting, but you've got to go back so far that there's some grey areas on some of the cars that we could never solve, that you could never – everyone's got their story about some of those Tiranas in the 70s and which one was that, which one was reshelled. Oh, yeah, there was one that was made up of two cut cars put together, and you'd probably have so many that you couldn't really definitively do. By the way, the Big Banger is not a part of that. I'm very clear on which one is which of those. But a HDT celebratory illustrated history from, you know, when did it start, what, 69 to the HDT brand, 87 Brock, I reckon I'd be up for that.
Yeah, definitely. There's definitely a book in it. But as you say, in terms of the individual cars, the further back you go, the sort of murkier it gets. And nowadays with those things being worth so much money, there's a lot at stake on those ones.
Yep, for sure. Now, this is one from an international listener, Stefano. We are worldwide on the V8 Sleuth podcast. Now, Xavier Moreau, and I'm sorry, Xavier, if you're Xavier. I think I've tried. I've got it from every angle. He's in Montreal in Canada, loves the pod, and is a Supercars follower and fan. He's been trying to understand the twin springs that were banned a few years ago in Supercars, and he can't find any pictures or video to explain. And are we a good place to perhaps ask the question? Well, we're a good place to ask the question. Stefano, can you give an answer?
Yeah, well, neither of us are engineers, so you've got to keep that in mind. But the very, very basics of it is you've got two linear springs stacked on each other with a little mechanical slider. So it allows you to have two spring rates if it's a twin spring. So you ideally want a stiff, if you put it in the rear of the car, which everyone was doing not too many years ago, some were running front as well, but it can be stiff on entry for stability and then soft on the exit for traction. So it just is a different rate depending on where the travel is. That's the nutshell of it.
And when was that banned? 19 they took that
out? Yeah, I think so.
Start of 19. So when the Mustang arrived, same time that'll happen. Yeah.
And so with all of that, it sort of adds cost because people end up with more of these things built up with all these different combinations and you need people to specifically look after your twin springs. But as with most things, like, they didn't end up putting off staff and saving cash when they drop this. They just deploy. If you've got the money there, if you've got the resource, you just go and spend it on something else.
They always find a way, these supercar teams, to spend money on all sorts of things, no matter what they do in the rules to try to curb it. Shane Jenkins, how many teams in the history of the Australian Touring Car Championship and Supercars Championship have completed a three-peat of championship wins but not with the same driver? Now, the illustrated point he makes, Stone Brothers with Marcus Ambrose, he won two in a row, and then Russell Ingall won the next year in 2005. A great work with the podcast, guys, loving it. So when you say stuff like that, you're an absolute guaranteed cert to get your question answered, pretty much. There's been a couple of these, though, over the journey. Stones, I think, are the only Ford team, though, to do it, but clearly HRT would have done it in their glory period, surely.
Yeah, with Craig Lowndes and Mark Scaife, you can cut that into 98, 99 and 2000 or 99, 2000 and 2001.
That's right. You get double. Was that twice? Did that? So therefore they did it twice, three in a row.
I reckon that counts.
Yeah. And Gibson's. They're the other one with the Nissans, with Scaife. Well, Richards first for 2 years, 1990-91, and Scaife in 1992. So, yeah, it's a pretty rare thing, actually, that this hasn't happened heaps of times. And for all those wins that Triple Eight were having in championships, they're always Wing Cup. And obviously Van Gisbergen won along the way in 16 and then again last year, but, you know, not connected to any of the Jamie wins to try to get them to add up that way.
The Gibson one was split nicely because in 91 when Richo won the title, didn't Mark end up getting more points, but they had to drop around?
Oh, I can't remember. It's the worst. If you ever hear anybody who says, we've got this great scoring system, you're going to drop your worst round, tell them to piss off. Seriously, it makes the history of the sport, it makes the way that you story tell it, it makes everything just too hard. Just if you've got to really get your abacus out and figure this all out, it's not a good system. Not a good system. Rod Binding, he doesn't have a question, Stefan, but he just wanted to say something. This was in capital letters on social. Bring back the Sandown 500. That's all. I'm cool with that. You good with this?
Well, they keep teasing us with things like co-driver practice. So they're going to have all the co-drivers at Sandown this year. But then
don't
after
start
one
me.
Session on Friday. Sorry, boys.
So it's like we're going to – if I see anyone run a retro livery at Sandown, I'll scream. But this has got to happen. And I know, look, there's bigger stuff going on in the world of supercars at the moment, but major metro event, lead up to Bathurst, play off our history, fans want it. I've talked to a couple of team owners. They want it. Come on, make it happen. We're going to have a Sandown event this year with the co-drivers at it. Add an extra little bit of running time on. Make it a 500 next year and let's get it going. And I don't want to hear the excuse about football finals because it's absolute crap. Absolute crap.
You're probably not going to want to hear about the E-Series Sandown 500 either then.
Oh, I read that too and that really pissed me as well. So we can have a made-up 500 in virtual land, but we can't in real life. But we can have co-drivers there and come on. Listeners, come with me on this. Bring back the Sandown 500. Make it trend, hashtag it. Post to us, send messages to supercars. We're going to make this happen. We will make this happen. Steph's looking at me like, oh, my God, what have you done? What have you done? But it makes sense. Bring it back. Fans want it. I want it. Let's do it. Peter Alexander. Peter's question, with the new Gen 3 cars being designed to have the front and rear clips removed in the event of a shunt, would each chassis still be thought of as being the same, even if it went through several front and rear clip replacements in the lifetime? Now, this is the good old grandpa's axe question, isn't it, really, Steph?
Yeah, it is, but the short answer is yes, it's the same chassis because plenty of the current ones have gone back to the firewall or had the birdcage out and replaced, and it's still that main frame is what the chassis is.
And the ID of it stays the same, whatever the number was. You could cut all sorts of other bars out, but as long as it's that central area, that's the main part of the chassis and you can cut and change all sorts of bars and bits, and it's at its core, it's grandpa's axe. You can change the handle so many times and it's still the axe. So therefore there is a certain line when you go, well, that's not all the original metalwork that car ran 3 years ago, but for ID purposes it's the same car.
Yeah, so what they've done with Gen 3 is just made it easier to replace those bits.
Are we going to see Gen 3?
Well, there's two of them.
It's a start.
Two guys to have a race, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. It's a bit hard to fit 23 other guys into them, though, at the same time. Jared Minogue, who's a guest you'd like to get the most, I presume he means on the podcast, but haven't been able to get? There's a few. I've asked if there's a few people who've said no, not because they don't like us, not because they don't appreciate what we do, but some people who just are not there with – they've left motorsport and they've just moved on with their life. Rick Kelly is one, and I've asked Rick a couple of times and I'm not going to annoy him about it. He knows that there's a standing invite to come on the show and have a chat, but he's just doing other things in his world and in his life and totally respect that and support that. So, you know, one day down the track maybe I can convince him to have a chat. Yeah, there's been a few other drivers, and I won't, you know, a few of them that just ummed and ahed about it but just thought, nah, just in another part of their life now and, you know, if they ever have a change of heart, then they know where to find us. But there's probably a few wish list guests, though, that we'd love to have on the podcast. Jason Plato. I want to get Jason Plato on the podcast. He's a right lad. He's a right lad.
Doesn't hold back. His book was pretty entertaining.
I'm really interested to ask him about some sections of his book from his Vauxhall British touring car days, that's for sure. So, and I think the biggest of big that I could ever aim to get is Dale Jr. Agree?
Mm-hmm.
Be pretty big.
Yeah, and someone who's driven a supercar.
Has too, and knows about podcasting. Very much so. He's kind of a big deal.
But before you turn over that page, the one that everyone asks about, the most requested, hasn't come up in this conversation yet. But you did get very close with one David Thexton.
Oh, okay. I think I've talked about this before, but I'm happy to talk about it again. We have this strange group of fans out there who are desperate for David Thexton to be on this podcast. So I went and made the time, connected with him, teed up a time for a Zoom chat, and he didn't turn up on it. And he didn't reply to any of my follow-up messages. So I'm not sure what else I can do. I tried. I put it all together, and it didn't come together. So what can you do?
Just adds to the legend, I reckon.
It adds to the jeez. Yes, right. Liam Briggs. Liam reckons we need a podcast on performance enhancement companies that ran side-by-side with touring car teams. HDT, HSV, FPV, Tickford, Wayne Gardner Racing and their Road Commodores. I don't reckon there's a podcast series in it, but I reckon there's some episodes to fit within the sleuth world on this sort of stuff.
Yeah, it's been an interesting adjunct to a few different teams, and obviously your HDT and the HSV connectivity into HRT was like the ultimate examples, really. But now we see on a smaller scale your Tickfords and the like sort of doing that stuff. But I find it interesting that Triple Eight have never played in that space.
Yeah. I'm not – well, I get it though, because they've always said they're an engineering company. So how do you make a buck out of – because quite often a lot of these businesses, particularly now in the more modern era, they're not cash cows. I mean, HDT Special Vehicles, Holden Special Vehicles, oh, yeah, big ticket business. Tickford FPV, solid business, but never to the degree of the red side of the feds. The WGR-inspired, what were they, enhanced Commodores, I guess you'd say, they ran into headaches with HSV, and they're a pretty small thing. I think there was even an Alan Jones Racing run of Falcons there in the EF type era of road cars out there. So there's been a bit of this stuff go on over the years. But they've always been short run things, and they've never really gone on to, you know, I think a lot of people have that thought that, oh, wow, you released this, this will be massive, bigger than Ben-Hur. There's a lot to it, and it's not as simple as you might think. So, yeah, but there's some content there to be had for sure.
And it's a crowded marketplace, massively. Like, neither of us are really road car aficionados, but it's a crowded market with not sort of big margins in it for these companies like Tickford. So I think when you look at something like Triple Eight, they can come out with their latest iteration of front suspension for race cars and say, oh, all right, customers, that's 40 grand, but it'll make you go a tenth faster, where you can't kind of say that to road car customers. They're like, oh, but this one's only like $500.
We'll take that on board, Liam. There might be something in that for us to explore in the future. Darren Burke, this is scary. V8 Superstars on DVD? Great to watch and entertaining. Stefan, please discuss.
So what era did this run? Because it finished up like mid-2000s, did it?
I think it finished, if it wasn't before the end of the Channel 10 era of supercars, it was not long before it. So I think it was still going in 05. So I presume it went till 06, the end of the deal. But that probably started in about 2001, maybe 02, somewhere around there. They used to do about four, maybe five a year with Channel 10. And they'd go and make big events of them at the casino in Perth and Crown in Melbourne and all sorts of locations where they had huge crowds for the recordings of these things. And if you don't know what V8 Superstars was, it was a panel show with six to eight V8 supercar drivers anchored each side of the fence by Mark Scaife and Russell Ingall generally. Billy Woods hosted it, I think. Lee Diffie did for a time as well too. And basically it just turned into an all-in argument. Everyone was yelling at everyone and no one really was ever heard. And but they pressed on with them. They did them for quite a few years. They'd be Channel 10 owned. They wouldn't be V8 Supercars owned from a rights perspective. I don't even know if they exist in the vault at Channel 10, and I don't think they'd probably make exciting DVD viewing. And look, the reality is where DVDs are going and the world's, you know, going streaming, it's going to get harder and harder and harder for our partners at Chevron Marketing Services, for example, to keep releasing DVDs when the market keeps shrinking and there's less and less of the major department stores actually having them on their shelves. So I think the question's more a case of could, you know, supercars, then you've got an issue. Channel 10 are not in the world now. They were for a time there recently, but they're not now. So I think that might be limited to whatever anyone might have recorded off the TV and have to watch at home. But do you remember those? Did you remember watching some of that over the journey?
Yeah, for sure. And I think David Bravham, like when he was at FPR at the end of 05, and he said on the show, like, this is V8 Super Egos, I think is what he branded it as, which was maybe the final show, and it summed it up quite well. But do you think it would work now as a concept?
This is really interesting because there's so many things where we would have so many of our listeners and our fans and our followers of motorsport fans who go, why don't they bring back this? Why don't they do that again? Why don't they? I think things are good. Things work in their time and in their era. And the rose-colored glasses are amazing things. Would this work now? I think it'd be cringe TV in 2022. And the reality is that
it was cringe TV then.
Yeah. Well, it's not going to change. So I think that, and it's clear, Fox are just covering the races now. There's no linking content in terms of programming. Like, they used to have that Inside Supercars, which kind of was, you know, it was panel and it was chat. And but as Jess Yates spoke on this very podcast about last year, I think it was, that I sort of asked her, well, why don't we have those lily pad programs that fill the gaps between? And I've got no doubt Fox are, you know, clearly it's budget related, but she said, look, the other fact is that things like your podcasts, other websites, other content is sort of doing that and filling those gaps in between. But I would have thought when you're a rights holder for the three major forms of the sport, Formula One, MotoGP and supercars, that having some form of programming that you create can be worthwhile. But, is it something – I think that the bit that you got to remember is it was the event element of them that backed it up. It wasn't just six or eight drivers in a studio. It was at a live event with 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 people in the room to create the atmosphere, to create the cash. So you need to make it an event that you got a television show out of rather than just making a television show. You need to bring that part of it in. And is there the audience for that these days to do the event, to stump up the money to go along to a night with a dinner and a, you know, it's a dinner and show, really? Look, maybe now that we're out of the other side of, well, we're not out of COVID, are we, but from being stuck in home or not able to travel, it would need an event element for it to work though, I reckon. But who would you make your six panelists or your two captains and your other people? That there's not the personalities in the field today to support it like there was then.
Yeah, this was the point that I was going to make. Like, you know, we mentioned the ego thing before, but they were big personalities and there was genuine and dislike between Russell Engel and Mark Scaife. Yep.
And they actually said stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So they definitely weren't afraid to say things like that. And it's just not the same now. And that's not all like being gagged by the teams and sponsors or anything. There's just not that same level of niggle going on, I don't think.
No.
So the way like it sort of narrows the appeal even more. But for a hardcore audience, I think the way to work better would actually be the team bosses.
Yeah.
And, totally. And we've seen in, say, like Netflix F1 Drive to Survive, like the big egos of those team principals are really played on and a big part of the show. And I think, in terms of the overall product, it would be probably better if it went that way rather than drivers.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that. Peter Burns, actually, this links to just what you said. How much power do supercars have in stopping drivers and teams running in other categories? Well, I think recent times might show that, well, a bit. Just fact. Fact. It's fact.
Yeah, it's hard to measure political power on a dyno.
Mm.
But
how many Newton meters?
I reckon it would spin up a pretty good number. The rap sheet on this is pretty long, isn't it? With things that have occurred due to political influence, whether it was the 12-hour, which Supercars ended up buying after all that. So this is just the latest saga, but a massive one with this Shane Van Gisbergen not being able to run in Trans Am, considering the ARG ownership of that category and part of Supercars.
Mm. Too many on Twitter. I had to say plenty of O's there because there are so many O's in the user handle. Would you guys consider doing a livery book, focusing less on the history of each chassis, instead the different variations of teams' liveries throughout the years, from all the different coloured Vodafone cars to the more obscure ones like the non-alcoholic Jack Daniels cars and so on and so forth? And it could be a great picture book because there's been a lot of livery tweaks and changes and tune-ups over the years, and one-offs and special causes and celebratory ones for milestones. There's probably been quite a bit there, but I'm not quite sure what the – is that a strong enough theme? I mean, we've got the content. We've got lots of photos. It's lots of interesting stuff, but is that a book? Could we do a book there?
Well, I think this is one of the things that people really like about the chassis books, that if you look at, you know, the one we're going to do with 888 or the ones that have already been done with HRT and so on, that it doubles as that, charting the liveries, and a lot of effort goes into selecting all the photos and making sure that some of these one-offs or most of them are included as well. So that's really a box that we try to tick as much as we can with the car books.
I tell you, somewhere where there is a lot of liveries, the National Motor Racing Museum at Mount Panorama, they're great friends of ours. They're open 6 days a week. They're not open on Tuesdays. This message is getting through because I'm seeing people on socials saying not open on Tuesdays. So this is definitely getting through. Of course, they've got an amazing array of race cars, motorcycles, speedway cars, memorabilia, wrecked cars as well as complete cars, all eras, all sorts of cars. Check it out. It's, of course, at Mount Panorama, the National Motor Racing Museum. We can't wait to get back up there for the Repco Bathurst 1000 in October. And I'm hearing that there's some special plans for some special cars to be in that museum for Great Race Week. So we'll keep you in the loop of what's going to be going on in October, which is not far away. It's scary how close that the Great Race is. We haven't had to wait as long this year because, remember, we were there in December. So we've sort of had 2 months less to wait for car racing's Christmas.
Driving around the city of Bathurst on 1000 weekend with Christmas lights out the front of lots of houses was very strange.
Yes, it was. It was. Craig Kondo, this is an interesting one. Where is the final Champ Car race winner from Long Beach in 2008 driven by Will Power? Funnily enough, I do know this. It does live in a private collection in the US. I'm pretty sure it's in a workshop in Indianapolis with a former Champ Car technical manager who is looking after it for its private collector owner. But that's those Panos DP01 chassis that they put in for that last year of Champ Car in 07 and then the one-off race at Long Beach when the reunification happened. I think Power has talked about these openly and lots of the drivers of the period that those cars were really good, really cool. They were a real waste in the end.
Yeah, I think they probably would have appreciated them even more once they got into those IRL or IndyCar, whatever it was called then. Cars on road courses, they weren't really designed for that. So the things that Power jumped into later in that year were nowhere near as nice as that Panos, I wouldn't have thought.
Remember they did standing starts when they got those Panos in Champ Car? They went to some different places too, those. I think Assen hosted a race in 07, but yeah, that Long Beach 08 race, although it was painted up as Team Australia, that was a KV Racing car, the Kevin Kulkoven, Jimmy Vassar team, and that was the farewell that the same weekend the IRL was racing in Japan at Motegi that Danica Patrick won her only IndyCar race at. Although the drivers at Long Beach earned points for the IndyCar series, this was all part of that whole bringing it all back together and some of the compromises that had to be made to reunify Champ Car back into IndyCar, or IndyCar into Champ Car, or whichever side of the fence that you were on to wheel it in. David Roberts. Now, David's a regular question asker, and I must admit that there's some of his questions along the way that we haven't been able to get to, but I wanted to make sure we got to this one because you were here for this Q&A. David asks, is it time for Motorsport Australia and supercars to join the rest of the civilised world and introduce minimum sector times under safety car conditions?
Absolutely. The answer to this is yes. It's unbelievable that in the modern world we don't have this. And there was a system developed and trialled by supercars a couple of years ago, and I'm not sure why it didn't come in.
I don't know.
But whenever the safety car's called, and it's no secret that everyone just blazes back to the pits.
Mm.
It's the combination of having the rules where you keep pit lane open, which I think is overall is a good idea for other reasons, but yeah, you need this delta time like they use so successfully elsewhere, including in F1. There's not too many controversies over that.
For the world in which we live of OH&S and high vis vests and risk mitigation, I can't believe we're still in 2022 and we haven't got some form of a system or a delta time or a system in the cars or anything like that to stop them from blazing around. I just have the... There's one thing that sticks in my memory, and I think it was about 2015 when Tim Blanchard was driving for Lucas Dumbrell, and he crashed at the top of the mountain just past Metal Grate at the wall there, which, you know, plenty of people have crashed there over the years. And the angle that the car was sitting on with cars just – it was at a critical part of the race when people were trying – you know, pitting was an important thing. People were hammering past that accident zone. If something happens bad in that situation – how do you explain to a coroner or to a court of law that you didn't have a system in place to mitigate that risk or to at least reduce it or remove it when you could have? I'm like you, I'm a bit staggered that there's been systems trialed, there's been discussions had, and we're still not there. Like, it's, they've done such a great job in safety in so many areas of this sport over the journey. I'm not just saying Motorsport Australia and supercars, I'm saying motorsport as a whole. But why haven't we got that sorted? I don't understand.
Yeah, and it can affect the response time of when marshals can actually get onto the circuit as well if the race hasn't been neutralised immediately.
Mm.
So I would very much like to see them introduce that, but not use that for a virtual safety car, because whenever there is a reason for a safety car, there's also a good entertainment value in having the safety car come out. There's nothing more frustrating than in F1 when a car's stopped on the side of the track and they put it virtual and it doesn't end up being a full safety car.
Oh, if you're going to do it properly, because it then actually adds an element. It's got the safety element at its core, but it brings the entertainment value into it as well, which I totally agree with, Sky Podmore, when will the next NASCAR Oscar DVD be available to buy? I reckon we've got a really growing, bubbling group of NASCAR, Oscar, Thunderdome fans who are lapping up this stuff. The good news is it's Volume 2's out later this year, November. It's got the 1990 Moomba Cup with NASCAR, Oscar and HQs on it, and the final rounds of Oscar NASCAR from the 91-92 Australian Super Speedway Championship at Thunderdome. So it's going to be some cool stuff there, and I reckon that there's something we have to do in Thunderdome land. We did a podcast, Will and I, some time ago, and it went crazy. Whenever we do the odd story on the website or podcast-related things, there's a massive NASCAR, Oscar audience out there who love this form of racing. Got to do something, surely, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And so looking at this, was that sort of 91, 92, would you say that was pretty much peak Australian NASCAR?
It's interesting to know when you would describe the peak, but it's, I mean, Oscar field's really strong, NASCAR field's 20, low 20s. Yeah, you'd have to say, I mean, that was when it was still televised by Channel 7. In many occasions it was late night or it was, you know, that afternoon or delayed. But, yeah, probably. Just about. I mean, I'm interested to hear what competitors might say, that they might feel it was a little bit later on or even in the early days when there was more Americans coming to those big international Christmas races. But I reckon you could mount a pretty good argument to say that that 90 to 92, 3 sort of period is probably just about its high point when you look at all the metrics. for sure. Yeah.
So you mentioned NASCAR, Oscar, HQ. Have you seen any of like the trucks or the Formula Vs? Didn't they run those as well?
Yeah, and I think they also ran Thunder Sports, sports sedans there with a like a chicane into the infield. But yeah, I've seen a little bit here and there, but not in the tape archives that I've been digging through for these ones. But yeah, there's a little bit of that stuff around the place. So we might have to wear a little bit of that over the journey because I think a lot of people wouldn't believe that that actually happened. It was a thing. Super trucks around the Thunderdome. Holy shit. Nuts. There's
some momentum going on there.
A momentum into the wall, I reckon. Jeez. Quick reminder too for our friends at the motorsporttrader.com.au. Head to their website, check it out. They're keeping motorsport memories alive. Luke and his team are all over it. They've got all sorts of memorabilia, race suits, car parts. Jump on their website, have a bit of a look, check it out, themotorsporttrader.com.au. Liam Baker. Now, this is off the back of the news of Pukekohe in New Zealand shutting up shop to motorsport. What's your top biggest shunt crash at that circuit? There's a few to pick from.
There are, like, wow, what a wild joint, and so sad to see it going. It's a tricky question because there has been some unfortunate outcomes to incidents at Pukekohe over the years. But if you just look at V8 racing in the recent past, there's actually one on YouTube from the NZ V8 series about 08.
Right.
With 12 cars going in at turn one off their rolling start, and a couple end up over the Armco. And
I've never seen this.
The commentator's yelling, "Holy snapping ring spanner," which is a pretty good line. So Beto was involved in that one. And I reckon it beats the one he had with PD that everyone talks about. Was that 05?
05.
Yeah.
Pookie in supercars, yeah. The one that springs into my mind is from a supercar round, but not V8 supercar car. And I didn't get a chance to sit down and look this up before we recorded this, but I'm pretty sure it was 2004. Now, there was a year where there were the race format at the time, a bit like now, one race Saturday, two races Sunday. But there was a Porsche GT3 Cup. They didn't run Carrera Cup over there. I think it was just a licensing issue, but it was the GT3 Cup, Carrera Cup cars. One of these Porsches went over on the main straight and went into the catch fencing well above the Armco and got stuck. Like, the fence caught it. Like, thankfully, it didn't go over into the crowd. And I'm pretty sure that no one was seriously injured anyway. It was one of those heart and mouth, holy hell, this is massive. Oof. But it caused so much damage to the fence. I'm pretty sure that was why the time delay meant that they couldn't run the supercar race that day, and they decided to then move it to the next day and have three races on the Sunday. I might be slightly wrong with my memory of that, but just the crash itself was a Kiwi driver, and I can't remember who it was, but it went up into this fence, and I remember seeing it standing not far from it thinking, holy hell, that was wild. But, I mean, John Bauer had that big one when the throttle jammed open on his BJR BOC Falcon and plowed in the fence and broke the leg of Scotty Wensley, our friend, the photographer who's been around motorsport for so many years. Paul Morris going over on his lid. Was that the same year when he and Brad Jones got together at the last corner and he ended up bouncing off the guardrail and going up and over? And, there's been some car wallopers there over the years for sure.
And both of those were the final year it was at Pukekohe before it went to Hamilton. In those days, those Armco barriers used to sort of act like ramps for that. And when they came back in 13, a lot of that was concrete.
Which was the concrete from the Hamilton street track that had been installed out at Pukekohe. So, yeah, wow, it is so sad. I haven't been to Pukekohe for some years though now. I can't remember the last year I would have gone there. I think it was 2014 from memory. And proper racetrack, proper crowd, proper history. It's sort of in the middle of nowhere and it's not that big of a facility. But I was lucky enough to do some on-track commentary there in my supercar era. And I think it was that 07 year. It was a crowded house, pretty big. And holy heck, like I remember calling, there was a change for the lead. And that grandstand went bonkers. Like, you reckon Aussies are nuts about V8 supercars and supercars? Kiwis go. And it wasn't even Murph taking the lead or a Kiwi driver. It was, I think it was Tanner and Winterbottom fighting it out at that stage. But I just remember the crowd went absolutely bananas. But when you're in that position too where you can call something and the way you deliver it or pump it up or sort of incite the Holden fans to get excited or the Ford fans or whoever it is and they respond in voice was really something powerful. So I'll never forget that from Pookie. And I think Larko still claims a win there, by the way. Remember that he won a race there for about 8 minutes?
And then it had been red flags and it went back?
Yeah, it was one of those ones that...
'01, was that the first actual...
I think it rained and, it all turned to muck. And somehow he was last man standing or they'd miscounted it or they'd stuffed it up somehow. And everyone knew that he hadn't won, but they flagged him and declared him as the winner. And then a short time later, of course, the man who had the mortgage on Pookie Car at the time, Greg Murphy, the landlord, turned up to collect the rent and take the win.
But you're right about it not just being an amazing racetrack, but the atmosphere and the way it's supported as well. Like I could only imagine what it would have been like in those peak Murph days in the early 2000s, but probably the best memory I've got of being there was 2018. I reckon there was all five Kiwis made the shootout and just like Richie Stanaway coming onto the front straight to start his lap, which he probably didn't have a lot of quality laps so far in his career that have had the focus of that, but just, the fan reaction to that, the passion for it, just incredible.
Yeah, amazing. And Kiwi Motorsport's going to be all the poorer for Pookie going. And I mean, just the history, not just the supercar history, but wind further back to the Tasman Series era and all the Formula One stars of the day running there. And, we're working on the Jim Richards book at the moment, that B&H six-hour proddy race that they ran there and, the link track. And you could go on and on about it for – forever. So we're sorry and sad to see Pookie go, and hopefully Supercars last year being this year in September can send it out in style. And I know that they're already plotting and planning some cool things to be able to pay respect, because of course it will forever remain the first international venue that the championship visited. 2001, before China, before Bahrain, before Abu Dhabi, before the Circuit of the Americas, before any of that, there was Pookie Coe. Troy Summerfield, this is scary. Is Randy Corners going to be the poster boy for hashtag bring back Sandown 500?
I'll let you deal with this one because he's your mate.
Well, he's Nathan Pretty's mate. He's not my mate. We might have to see if he's available and if our budget can cover his seriously high contractual demands, because I'm guessing they're going to be pretty through the roof.
And the legal costs and all that sort of
thing. Yeah. I need to get the lawyers on speed dial. Might have to be Callis Kenny Intellect's lawyers, our partners, to look after that one. They're supporting the pod and supporting our website at the moment, so we might have to dial them up and see if they can help us out. Brent Gower, this is interesting. What's the best piece of memorabilia you own?
I'm going to defer to you first because we are in the V8 Sleuth office at the moment. And there's plenty of cool stuff in here. What's your pick?
Well, not all the cool stuff's in here. Some of the cool stuff's hidden away as well in other places. But best piece. I've got some cool race suits that I've collected over the journey, but I think the coolest thing I've got, I have Peter Brock's Marlborough. Are you allowed to say that? I'm not advertising it, I just say it for history's purpose, so it's okay. Holden Dealer Team jacket from 1979, 1980. It has the 0.05 logo of the era attached to the sleeve. It's visible in photos of the era. It was given by Peter to the young head of his supporters club in 1980, I think it was, because if you're going to be the head of the supporters club, you need to look the part, so Brock gave him the jacket. And
I was about to say you were pretty young.
No, it wasn't me. I'm an 81 model, so I wasn't around then. But it was with that owner for many, many years, and recently acquired that because I thought that was just so cool. And it's period. It's Brock. It's HDT. It's something very, very cool. So there's some cool race suits hanging around here as well, and a few that are tucked away in bags and boxes. If I've got to pick a race suit that's a bit of a personal favourite, and I actually had this on display and on loan to the National Motor Racing Museum a little while back when they had a Craig Lowndes exhibition. Remember that the Vodafone 2012 Bathurst Retro Livery HDT lookalike car? I've got one of Craig's suits from that year's Bathurst, which, it didn't win the race, but I think it's probably really strongly remembered by people, 10 years ago this year. Probably more so even than the fact that Wincup and Dumbrell actually won the race. It's that that retro livery had such a connection to fans of Brock and the dealer team, and that's pretty cool. So yeah,
you've gone the double Marlboro.
Yeah, I have actually. I've never smoked in my life, so it's clearly never affected me. So, what about you, Stefano? What do you got lying around? You got anything of interest?
Oh, I don't think I'm going to follow those sorts of things in. So, yeah, it's one of those ones. Like, I've got a couple little things that either teams or drivers or whatever have sort of given over the years, which wouldn't sound that impressive if I listed it off. But things that remind you of things or whatever else. Yeah, it's a nice thing.
Cool. I like it. Craig Kondo had another question, so I thought we'd fire this one in. How long is the current controlled tyre supply contract? If the issue of tyre overheating when behind another car is not solved by the introduction of Gen 3, is it time to open up the controlled tyre supply for tender? I did some homework. Dunlop's deal of 5 years was announced in November 2019, so they have a deal in place until the end of 2024. So there's not going to be any change anytime soon. And I don't think a change of tyre brand is – those two things aren't connected.
Yeah, I would say that you sort of get what you're willing to pay for. Mm. Like it's a just below $300 tyre. So if they wanted to go really funky with it, they might be able to do that within Dunlop's capability, you would think, but it might require a different level of investment. But, yeah, we'll see how it works with Gen 3.
It's been a really long partnership. Dunlop's been the control tyre supplier since 2002 to supercars. Of course, control tyres came in 99, and it was a Bridgestone contract for the first 3 years, but it's been Dunlop ever since with a couple of, you know, contracts along the way. But they've generally been a longer-term 4 or 5 year type contract. They haven't been doing – you can't really do a two or a, you know, small era period one with – something so important that needs all that lead time to create the product and to get it out here and to test it and all that sort of stuff. It's they've been a really – and I've got no commercial interest in this, but, you know, it's pretty rare that a commercial partnership like that with a category or a sporting brand, you know, 20 years is a pretty solid run, pretty solid run.
And the important point to make is that they will open it to tender. They tend
they
to do
when it yeah. is out every time. It's not like they just automatically – roll it over, but the other question is who else is out there that can pony up the money and the technical know-how to actually even apply for it or to try to take it on. But we see sometimes fans asking, can they take it back to open tyres? And I think control tyres the best thing that – and the irony of it is, here's another little point, for the fact we have a control tyre now where everyone's got the same – we still have so much tyre chat.
More than
can
ever.
You imagine the tyre chat if we had three brands and six compounds? Oh, let's not go there. Let's not go there. Will Tatnall, don't know if he's related to Brooke, regular listener of the podcast and loving the work you guys do. Therefore, question will get asked. If you were running a team for the Bathurst 1000, past or present, who would you choose to drive your car, whether it's drivers from the ATCC, NASCAR, WEC or Formula One? Now, I don't normally put in hypothetical questions here, but I thought he's a listener. He loves the work we do. We're nearly finished this episode. It's the second last question. So why not? Throw it in there.
Are you stalling while you're trying to think of
No, I've already got my answer clear. Do you want me to like stretch mine out so you can think of yours, or have you got yours?
Well, I'm not all that imaginative with these ones. I like to swim between the flags. So, and it's partly influenced by the project we're doing at the moment and the way supercars is at the moment. But I think Shane Van Gisbergen and Jim Richards, like peak Jim Richards, would be a pretty good combination.
Now that you say peak, when is peak Jim Richards? Are we talking JPS BMW Jim Richards? Are we talking Winfield Nissan Jim Richards? What's peak Jim Richards?
I would say pretty much any time from the mid-60s to the to about 2020
yeah.
when he retired.
Yep. No, that's a fair point. Brock and Lowndes, the combo that never happened. How big would that have been? I mean, they were in the same team but in opposite cars. They were never put together in the same car. That would have been – for me, if I was running a team past or present – and I could choose from history and I can do whatever I like, I would have made that happen.
I reckon you'd probably win the column inches battle as well. I reckon your press calls for your team might have a few more words uttered than mine.
And the merchandise rights would be pretty good to have as well, just quietly. Last question of our Q&A podcast. Trent Erza, could you see supercars end up going down the DTM path and running GT3 cars in the future?
Not really. I think there's a lot of discussion about this, whether it's like people have talked in the past about GT3 or GT4 or now Trans Am, but I do think we need our own formula in Australia where you're not beholden to getting your spare parts from overseas and everything that comes with that. So GT3 in particular is like such a different product to what a supercar is, regardless of how many doors the supercars have. So no, I don't see it going down that path, and I don't think it should.
I think as our top category, we've done the whole follow the world thing before, and we've had our best days and our best times when we've done our own thing, and other parts of the world have done the same when they've gone native to their market. They've done what they needed to do, and I mean, take DTM as the example here. What else could they do? Because they had blown themselves out of the water with cost of that category of those cars, and then the manufacturers all disappear. So they didn't have this thing that could still carry on without manufacturers. Supercars has, you know, had the vision over time, and it's been accelerated in the last 5 years, 6 years, whatever it is, of no manufacturers actually being there, or in a much reduced sense where, you know, we weaned ourselves off cigarette money in the mid-90s. We've been weaning ourselves off manufacturer money. So I think, you know, supercars probably done a very good job of that in comparison to other categories where DTM just had to carry on, had to do something, and GT3 was the logical, easy thing. So I think you're right. I think we need something that's ours, that's native to us, that's going to appeal to our audience here, because at the end of the day, if, you know, GT racing's around, it's a thing. It's popular and gets eyeballs when it's the 12-hour at Bathurst, but when it's not that, I mean, GT racing's always going to be focused and built on gentleman / professional racing and customer racing. So you do that and you rip the guts out of an industry here of people who are paid to build things, fix things, repair things, supply things. You pretty much wipe most of them out if you go down this path, because all you're doing is ringing Germany or the US or Europe to order another X amount, $100,000 worth of parts.
Or another $1 million complete race car.
Yeah. So to answer the question, Trent, not anytime soon. It's probably the simple version. Steph, have you enjoyed your return to the V8 Sleuth podcast? It almost feels like we're stealing you back from our sister podcast. We'll let you go back there next week, but have you enjoyed yourself here?
Definitely. We've had a go. Hopefully the answers have been as good as the questions.
We had a good mix for this episode, so thanks everyone for sending them in. Keep following us on the socials. We've got a contact page on our v8sleuth.com.au website to keep on rolling in through as well, so keep the notifications coming through, and the questions and the feedback and the thoughts. We get random thoughts from people too. They're not asking questions so much, but just making statements. Hey, we love hearing from you all through all the various ways that you can get in touch. The Motorsport Podcast Network is our banner that we put a whole pile of motorsport content underneath. Tuesdays, Castrol Motorsport News Podcast with award-winning hosts Andrew Van Loon and Stephen Bartholomaeus. I think that's now in your contract, that I have to refer to it as award-winning every time. I mean, award-winning within 2 months of being established. So you've set a high bar there, boys. You better keep matching that for next year. Repco Supercars Weekly every week, either Thursday or Friday, depending on the news of the week. And, of course, the V8 Sleuth podcast, powered by Repco, every Wednesday, with plenty of good guests coming up in upcoming months on the road to the Repco Bathurst 1000. Thank you, Stefano, for sitting down with me. Thanks, everyone, for sending in the questions. Review, rate, and subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to our podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we'll chat to you next week.